This is episode 165 of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, 10 Things You Didn't Know About Pressure Ulcers.
The Nursing Home Abuse Podcast is dedicated to providing news and information for families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. Here are your hosts, Georgia attorneys Rob Schenck and Will Smith.
Hello out there. Welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I'm going to be your host for this episode. We are going to do another top 10 episode in the style of David Letterman. For those out there that used to watch David Letterman back in the day, he would do the top 10 list. This is our own version of the top 10 list. So top 10 things that you didn't know about pressure ulcers. Number 10, pressure ulcers should not be backstaged. So very quickly, what staging is that a nursing home, pressure ulcers occur on a continuum that we've determined to be in four stages. So stage one and two, the pressure ulcer has either not broken the skin yet or has broken just the first layer of skin. Stages three and four, which are full thickness ulcers, the wound has gone below the skin into the tissue in the muscle below. So we go stage one to stage four, one being the least developed, four being the most developed. So what happens sometimes is that a nursing home will document the pressure ulcer. Let's say that we're at a stage three pressure ulcer. And let's say that they revise the care plan like they're supposed to, that they reassess the resident and they make a new care plan with that stage three pressure ulcer, interventions to heal that pressure ulcer. The care plan has the objective to heal that pressure ulcer based on the interventions. Now, let's say that those interventions worked and the pressure ulcer begins to heal such that it goes from that full thickness wound to back to a partial thickness wound. So it either you could consider it to be at stage one or stage two. Okay. So it was stage three, it's healing and it's getting covered back up with the skin. It would technically either be stage one or stage two. At this time, it is not appropriate to refer to that ulcer as stage one or stage two. It should always be staged at its highest stage. In other words, you can't backstage the pressure ulcer. So once a stage three, always a stage three. And that's important because typically, once you get an ulcer to stage three or stage four, the damage is done. The area under that skin is going to be compromised and you're therefore more susceptible. So in terms of the risk involved, it's better to say that you have a stage three there forever, because essentially it's not going to take that long to get back to a stage three. So no backstaging of pressure ulcers. If you see in your loved one's records that it was a stage four, and then 6 months later it's a stage two, that is actually incorrect from a clinical standpoint and could lead to problems, and it could lead to a misconception on it for shifts later on down the road on how to care for that area of the body that was a stage three or stage four. Okay, number nine, smoking can prevent proper wound healing. This was such a news flash to me. I had no idea about this before I started this podcast. Even taking Betzer cases, I learned this on an earlier episode of this podcast that smoking cigarettes, in fact, will help prevent a wound from healing. And how does that work? Well, the primary problem with pressure ulcers is that the pressure prevents proper blood circulation in that area of the body. So the tissues in the skin don't get the nutrients or the oxygen that's required to be healthy. So it's like a circulatory issue, a blood flow issue. And so smoking helps to deprive the blood of oxygen, and it puts other carcinogens and other things that you don't want in the blood. So you're reducing the oxygen that's going to the blood. You're reducing the nutrients going into the part of the body that needs it. And you're putting in bad things, carbon monoxide, that type of stuff. So Smoking can have a detrimental effect to wound prevention and wound healing. So that's a number, that's a very important, that's number nine. Number eight, pressure ulcers are either avoidable or unavoidable. And those words are terms of art. An unavoidable pressure ulcer is one that occurs on a person, even though the nursing home has properly conducted a comprehensive assessment and assessed that resident for its or his or her risk of developing pressure ulcers. The nursing home, second, has put in place a care plan to address that resident's risk of pressure ulcers and has reviewed and revised that care plan where appropriate. Where the nursing home does all three of those things, assessment, care plan, revise the care plan, and the pressure ulcer still develops, then we call that an unavoidable pressure ulcer. It's not relevant what chronic illnesses the resident has, the age of the resident, mobility of the resident, the cognitive impairment of the resident. The only thing that matters in determining whether that pressure ulcer is avoidable or unavoidable is that the nursing home does all three of those things. All of a resident's characteristics and risk factors should be placed into that assessment, into that care plan, and be considered when revising and reviewing that care plan. So in other words, just because a person has diabetes doesn't mean that it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to have unavoidable pressure ulcers. The question is, what did the nursing home do about the diabetes as a risk factor for that specific resident? Avoidable, unavoidable, only. It's kind of like Yoda, do or do not, there is no try. Avoidable or unavoidable, there is no other category. Number seven, pressure ulcers can come from friction and medical instruments. So on this program, we dedicate about 90% of our time when talking about pressure ulcers to the most common pressure ulcers, that being those caused by prolonged pressure on certain parts of the body, so the buttocks and the heels and the shoulder blades. But pressure ulcers actually can come from when a resident is transferring. So moving the body, shifting the body around when going from the bed to a wheelchair, or going from, you know, the bed onto a lift. Any instance in which skin, particularly moist skin, which can be more frail, is the shear, the impact of the movement and the bone inside the body moving underneath the skin on that surface as they're moving, that friction can be the basis for a pressure ulcer injury. Also, when I say medical instruments, like things like trach tubes or casts, like when you break your arm, you get a cast, these type of things, prolonged pressure on that part of the body or friction on the skin can also cause pressure ulcers. So these are set kind of subcategories on their own of pressure injuries, those caused from friction or shear, and those caused from medical instruments. Not quite as common, at least in my experience, not quite as common, but they do in fact happen in the nursing home. The nursing home must account for these things in the assessments and in the care plans. Number six, refusal or non-compliance on the part of the resident is not an excuse for bedsore development. So oftentimes in our cases, we see that a nursing home is blaming the pressure ulcer on the resident because the resident has refused to eat their protein supplement or didn't want to be turned or repositioned at a two-hour interval. Non-compliance by the resident as an excuse. Non-compliance by a resident's choice to decline care is not an excuse for neglect. This is an instance in which the nursing home is going to be required to revise the care plan. And part of that means finding out why the resident has declined the care. Is it because when turning and repositioning the resident, it hurts? Is it a privacy issue, a dignity issue? If so, what are the alternatives? These are the type of things that need to be addressed by the nursing home before noncompliance can be used as a sword against that resident. What alternatives, what did the nursing home do to reassess, reevaluate, update that care plan to try to work around the noncompliance of the resident? Because again, sometimes the it's not a choice. So, I mean, pain isn't a choice. If it hurts, that's why the resident might be refusing it. Sometimes the resident is acting out for reasons other than what seems obvious. So maybe it's a side effect to medication. So in other words, just because the resident refused to be turned, just because the resident refused, whatever the case may be, doesn't mean it's a foregone conclusion that they should get a bed sore. And number five, nutrition and hydration are critical to wound healing. Number five, nutrition and hydration are critical to wound healing. We've had a whole episode dedicated to the healing of pressure ulcers. We had guest Martha Kelso on episode 138. That's a great episode if you want to learn more about that. But in that episode, she explained that it's important to get the appropriate amount of nutrients. Because remember that pressure ulcers are essentially comes down to a circulatory problem. And the point of the blood, the point of the circulation is to feed oxygen and nutrients to the body. And when it doesn't get it, it breaks down. So understanding that, you want to at least be able to ingest the nutrients that you're going to need to heal that wound, to get the blood, to take it to that wound area and heal it. And that includes protein. Protein is essential and vital for wound healing. It helps build muscle. It helps build tissue. So whenever you have a loved one that has a pressure ulcer in that care plan, they're hopefully should be an intervention that says this individual should increase their amount of protein. That can either be done through shakes, like vitamin supplements, or through the meal plan itself, like the food that they're intaking should compensate for protein and calories. Obviously, calories should be increased, or that should be looked out for. You don't want to have a decrease in calories, because calories, again, you want to have an appropriate amount of calories in order to build up the muscle again. So nutrition, hydration, these things are super critical to wound healing. Standard of care requires that nursing homes document wound integrity issues on every resident. So if the nursing home observes a reddened area, non-blunsable area, that needs to be documented. And then subsequent documentation needs to build on that. So if there's a stage three pressure ulcer, in order to really care and provide treatment, you have to understand it. And from shift to shift, you need to have documentation showing the progression or the healing of that wound. So in order to do that properly, you know, there you need to have a description of the size, which in the length, width, the depth of the wound. What does the skin around the edges of the wound look like? Does it have an odor? Are there complaints of pain? So documenting where the wound is at is vital, because that provides the basis for understanding it, you know, 3 shifts from now, 3 days from now, 3 weeks from now. Is it getting better or getting worse? We only know that if we have proper documentation, proper descriptions. So nursing homes staff should be trained on the appropriate way to document and observe those wounds. So number three, multiple pressure ulcers mean the care plan should be revised. So we have mentioned before that care really comes down to assessment, care plan, and revision of care plan. So whenever a resident has developed a pressure ulcer, that should automatically be an indication that the care plan should be revised. So assessment, care plan, revision. So new interventions created to treat that pressure ulcer. So if the nursing home has developed new interventions and are effectuating those interventions, but still another pressure ulcer develops, then that's going to call for another revision of the care plan, because something is falling through the cracks here. Something that they're doing is potentially not right. So whenever there is a development of a new pressure ulcer, the nursing home should go back and revise that care plan, try to figure out what's going on. So if you have it on the left side or on the buttocks and you got one on the left side, you know, is there something that they can do with wedges? Is there something that they can do with a more frequent turning or repositioning schedule? These type of things. Interventions for the purpose of healing that new wound. So revising that care plan. Number two, high-risk residents should be evaluated weekly. What that means is that after a comprehensive assessment, if that resident is at a high risk for developing pressure ulcers, then that resident on a weekly basis, at minimum, needs to do a head-to-toe skin assessment of that resident. Because obviously, if they're at a high risk, then you want to be looking out for it. So what this means is that the resident by a nurse or wound care nurse is given a head-to-toe assessment of their skin integrity. So what's documented would be, you know, moisture. Is the resident sweating profusely? Is the resident incontinent? Is the incontinent episodes, are they frequent? Are they infrequent? Things that would place them at risk for skin integrity. On top of just a head-to-toe observation of any type of skin impairment. So are there reddened areas? Are there areas where there are scratches? These type of things. So that needs to be done on at least a weekly basis for those residents that are at a high risk for developing pressure ulcers. And again, comprehensive assessments should occur at regular intervals. And the skin assessments are just a part of that comprehensive assessment. But once that assessment spits out that the resident is at a high risk for skin integrity issues, then at least that skin assessment needs to occur now every week. Number one, assessments should take into account chronic illnesses. So again, the name of the game is avoidable and unavoidable. Just because the resident has a history of diabetes or a circulatory issue or anemia or whatever the case may be, does not mean that that's an excuse for that resident to develop a pressure ulcer, okay? The assessment needs to take into account those chronic illnesses and chronic issues, and the care plan should have interventions in place that account for those and work around them. So if the individual has diabetes, then an intervention to prevent pressure ulcers might be to make sure that it stays in check, that insulin levels are checked, so that way it's controlled. And then maybe the interventions might be, okay, we're going to have specific interventions to check their feet their buttocks at regular intervals, like I said, like the weekly assessment. So there are ways around chronic illnesses that, you know, just because, you know, there are a lot of people that are old and have chronic illnesses, but not everybody has pressure ulcers. So it's up to the nursing home taking a person-centered approach, a resident-centered approach in that assessment to prevent pressure ulcers for that specific resident in spite of chronic illnesses and chronic condition. So that's your top 10 things you didn't know about pressure ulcers. If you found this episode informative, if you found it enjoyable, please like and subscribe, share it with people that might find it interesting like you did. If you're watching this on YouTube, please like and subscribe, please comment, let us know how we're doing. New episodes of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast come out every other Monday. Again, if you have suggestions for comment, let us know. But with that, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes are available every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.